We all have a limited amount of time, energy, and money in our lives to do virtually anything. And so all of us are concerned. We look out upon this world and we see so much wrong about it. So we always are asking ourselves, at least I am, is where can I put my limited time, energy, money to where it's going to do the most good? Can it do any good? And it's a great question you're raising. And I keep going back to the fact that the only thing that I know that we can do at this point in time is just keep communicating with one another and hope that over time that we will raise enough people's awareness that some real change can actually happen. But, you know, even if we fail to succeed, and let's just say that they actually prevail and we go into a tailspin, into a dark age where we really live in a serfdom type of a feudal system like that, even if that occurs, you know, we have to do, as we live here today, we have to do something. And sounds like you've done, you know, your fair share.
Well,
but we're obligated, win, lose, draw, or indifferent. We're obligated to do the best that we can at any one point in time.
Of course, we all have to keep on keeping on. But I'm just saying that the first thing we better realize is that there is no process. There is no known process. That when people say vote and vote people out of office, you said it a little while ago, and so on, that's really, no offense, but I mean, that's nonsense. The people in office, by the time you get to where you could possibly get into office, you're already completely sold out. You know, there's no way that, and then when somebody like Robert Norris, for instance, I don't know if it, but, you know, starts laying, lambasting Sam Farr or something like that, and so, what the hell could Farr do? I mean, he's a poor little nebbish and so on, and he's in the Congress. It doesn't matter really which way he votes. It doesn't matter which way he votes. The truth about this country is that we're living under martial law. And I've just been learning something about the history of that. We do live under martial law. We don't live under the Constitution. We don't have a constitutional government. We've got a corporate government that governs by the Uniform Commercial Code. The United States is a bankrupt government. And you and I and the rest of us are all assets of the corporation. We become assets of the corporation at birth. And the number of our asset name is the number of our birth certificate, followed up by the numbers that we get on Social Security numbers and so on and so on. I mean, it's an incredibly dense web of deceit. And everybody is being pushed so hard just for the struggling to stay alive that, you know, that it's only people like me who have the good fortune or whatever you want to call it to have the leisure and then happen to be turned in that direction to be able to start finding out about what's going on. But even so, and there is a way. There's this wonderful book, I think I may have mentioned it to you before, called Cracking the Code. And it's absolutely, you know, it's an incredible book. But even that, when people, and it shows you not only what's wrong and how it got that way, but also how you can declare your own independence. But it has to be done one person at a time. It can't, in other words, I can't take what I know, even after I filed my papers and so on, in order to get free of this whole thing. I can't go down and help, for instance, the homeless or people that are being beaten up at peace demonstrations and so on, except in very minor ways.
Well, I must say that I think you've articulated our situation real, very clearly and succinctly. Anyone out there listening, I think you've said it all. It's a corporate fiction. We're living under martial law. The Constitution has been suspended. We're bankrupt. I mean, that has to get some people's attention as to what's going on, and you said it so clearly. And so I think you're doing some good just calling in right now.
I know, but you know, the terrible thing, of course it does some good, Tom, but what it does, we still have to, the fact is that no matter what you become aware of, the main thing that I'm aware of is our helplessness and the fact that most people, simply because it's so unbearable to to recognize that there isn't a damn thing you can do. I mean, I personally do believe that Bush is clinically insane. But once you know that this country has been ruled by executive order ever since the Civil War, that Lincoln, you know, that when Lincoln, when the seven states walked out of the Congress and so on, Congress didn't have a quorum anymore, and therefore the Congress disbanded because they couldn't do business. They didn't have a quorum, a constitutional quorum in the Congress. Lincoln, under his power as commander-in-chief, reconvened the Congress in a few days, and basically the Congress has never, and then no peace treaty was signed at the end of the so-called Civil War.
Right.
And because of that, the entire country has been ruled by executive order since Lincoln, since 1861. In 1871, the United States was incorporated as a corporation to do business for profit in commerce, and everything kind of flows from there.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we look forward to hearing from you from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So we're going to be, of course, calling, and hopefully Joel Scowls in here in just a few minutes. Hopefully, if we don't call him, he will call us, but we're looking forward to having his insightful analysis of what's going on in America today. So right now, of course, just want to point out that, you know, America and the average American believes we won the war. We won the war in the Middle East, and of course, isn't it great now? Now we can get back to peace. Our troops are going to be coming home, and before too long, once we've established democracy in the Middle East. The problem with that is, of course, we went into the First World War with the slogan to make the world safe, democracy. If we really believe in democracy, why isn't there democracy in Afghanistan today? Why are we supporting the military dictatorship in Algeria, the one-party system in Egypt? Why are we, have until recently, supported the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia? Why are we supporting the military in Turkey, which, of course, isn't really representative of the will of the people at all? Fortunately, the parliament was elected by the people, and they didn't like what the military wanted to do. That's why we couldn't bring our troops through there. But of course, because of what we've been doing in the last few years, the majority of the Muslim population of Turkey has really turned to the radical Islamic form of belief, and we have created basically a radical Islamic state in Turkey in response to America's foreign policy. Now, what is this really all about? Well, one has to only go back, and we're hoping, of course, we're going to be able to get Joel Scowson, but if we can't, it's going to just be you and me. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But, of course, you must understand that there really was no radical Islamic movement in the world at all until 1980. And at that time, why the American government began financing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Now, there was no Afghan war at the time. This was in July of 1979. But Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the master architect of all of the problems we have today, began to talk to President Carter into beginning to finance the Mujahideen, which then began to try to destabilize the pro-communist government in Afghanistan. And in response to the fact that we were financing the Mujahideen, why the Soviets invaded Afghanistan to ensure that their puppet government would remain in place. Now, if you want to verify that statement, it comes from a book called Unholy Wars by, I think it was John Cooley, who's a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. But it's a fascinating, fascinating book, and we certainly recommend it to you. And so if you go ahead and check the facts out, you'll find that actually 10 years after the fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski bragged about how he had precipitated the Afghan war. Well, once we had the Afghan war going, then, of course, why we could justify the CIA going over, recruiting Muslims from everywhere in the world to come come to Afghanistan to fight in this holy war against the wicked Soviets. And in the process, we began to indoctrinate them in this radical form of Islam, which was known as Wahhabism, which existed really no place in the world outside of Saudi Arabia. And with help from the Saudis, and of course, utilizing the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, as an intermediary, we financed the radical Islamic movement. The CIA did. They created this whole radical Islamic movement. It was during the 1980s that the United States began spending massive amounts of money, $56 million, on textbooks that were distributed to schools in Afghanistan, pushing the radical Islamic movement, how wonderful it was to die in jihad, to die fighting for Allah, how wonderful it was to die killing the infidels. And they had pictures of, of men, wearing bandoliers. Everything was to indoctrinate the youth, the Muslim youth, in this radical form of Islam, this whole idea of fighting and dying, so that was the one way you were sure that you were going to get into paradise. Otherwise, as a Muslim, you're never really sure you're going to get to paradise. You hope you would, but of course there's a tremendous fear of hell within the makeup of the Muslim faith. Now, we spent $56 million. You could not spend money in the United States to push religion, but you could spend our money over in Afghanistan to indoctrinate the youth there in this radical form of Islam. Is this really true? Well, if any of you would like to get the article out of the Washington Post, we'd be glad to send you copies of it. And then, of course, when the war ended in 1988, the Afghan war ended, why, of course, Osama bin Laden, who had worked with the CIA all during that war, whose father and, whose entire family was very close to the Bushes, why Osama bin Laden organized al-Qaeda with these Muslims that we had brought to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And they were sent back then to their individual nations to begin to work towards Islamic countries, Islamic states in these other nations. Now, you have to understand that it was right after the Gulf War. In fact, it was during the course of the Gulf War where the United States government, after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, why the United States government went to the Saudis with pictures, satellite pictures, and said, look, Saddam Hussein is getting ready to invade Saudi Arabia, and he's going to take over your country unless, of course, you let us bring our troops in here. And so the Saudis looked at these pictures and never for one minute thought that we would be showing them pictures that really weren't accurate. I mean, they found it difficult to believe that the American government would lie to them. But there was a woman, of course, who was actually working for the St. Petersburg newspaper, and she actually got similar satellite pictures, and of course they were shot by the Russians. And the same pictures which the Americans said showed all of these Iraqi tanks and Iraqi divisions poised on the edge of the border with Saudi Arabia, The Soviet satellites didn't show them at all. She bought and paid for hers. I assume we just simply fudged ours because we convinced the Saudis they had to let us station our troops in Saudi Arabia. And when we did that, of course, Wyatt laid out the basis for what was to occur. And that was, of course, that, of course, this whole Islamic movement suddenly felt that crusaders were stationed in the Holy Land. They were stationed there adjacent to Mecca and Medina. And this inflamed the passions of Muslims throughout the world. That, and of course, America's backing of Israel, but that was not the major thing. It was not our backing of Israel as much as it was the fact that we were stationing our troops. We were taking over, from their point of view, Saudi Arabia. And it was all manipulated. It was all very carefully calculated to produce a radical Islamic movement. And that, of course, is what most people do not understand today, is we created the best enemies that money could buy. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you would like to, of course, give us a call, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question or comment upon what we've said. Now, there have been a number of books written about the financing of the radical Islamic movement. One of them, of course, was Dollars for Terror. It was written by a Swiss television journalist who spent 4 years traveling throughout the Middle East, and in 1999, his book, Dollars for Terror, was released. And what did it say? Why, of course, this Islamic movement is being funded by Saudi Arabia, by Pakistani intelligence, and in certain areas by the American Central Intelligence Agency. 1999, the book Dollars for Terror. Now, why should we believe there's any truth to that book? After all, couldn't it be mistaken? Well, of course, if you read Unholy Wars by James Cooley, you'll find out that the United States government financed the Taliban. The United States government was financing Al-Qaeda. You'll find out that we actually financed this whole Taliban movement that we eventually destroyed. What's wrong with this picture? It was in 1994 when Stephen Emerson produced a video that was to be shown on American television and was talking about all of the Islamic terrorist cells in the United States. And the government, probably our intelligence agency or CIA, allowed it to be shown one time, and then they used it, however they did it, I don't know. But they blocked that video from ever being shown in America. Again, why? Because the American people were not to realize that Islamic terrorism was a threat. And so they actively suppressed here in the United States video. And it could not be shown. It was not really shown or available at all in the United States until after the terrorist attack. Some 7 years later. Why was that? Because they were manipulating what the American people think. And then, of course, at the same time, in 1996, there was testimony before before the Senate Intelligence Committee by an American Muslim. And, of course, this testimony by the American Muslim simply pointed out that a great deal of money was being raised here in the United States for the Islamic terrorist movement. And yet, of course, the average American has no knowledge of that at all. And, of course, that was totally suppressed by the controlled media, so that the average American didn't understand that much of the money for this whole terrorist movement, Hezbollah, Hamas, and, of course, for Al-Qaeda, was being funded right here in the United States. And this, of course, is the problem we have, is because of the media control, the average American doesn't understand. There's been an organized, orchestrated effort to create the best enemy that money can buy. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. We're going to play a little music. We're going to just see if we can track down our good friend, Joel Skousen, because I know that you'll enjoy hearing what he has to say about what's going on in the world today. So let's play a little music, and we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and at long last, why we have Joel Skousen with us, so let's get on with the program. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Well, I'm certainly sorry, Stan. We had this telephone problem, but now we're okay, and we're back online.
All right, fine. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your latest World Affairs brief and the things that, of course, you were concerned about.
Well, it's very interesting. Let me give your listeners a little bit of an update about what's going on in Iraq right now, because the president had just spoken today about assuring everyone that he's going to let Iraq have exactly the kind of government that it wants, and we're not there to impose our form of government, our culture, or anything else upon Iraq. But the facts of the matter speak something much differently. There was a meeting, of course, today of some 300 Iraqi leaders, but I listened to several Iraqi dissidents now explaining that they've all been handpicked by Jay Garner. They really do not represent a total cross-section of Iraq, that there's a high percentage of these people that are Iraqi exiles, which are not liked very well within Iraq themselves. Most of those people have not been in Iraq for the past 12 to 15 years, and so they're not looked upon as having any real experience on the ground or understanding. They're looked upon as puppets of the Americans, which clearly is the case. So this is a growing problem for the United States. It's very clear that they are, I think, intending to impose within the next 30 days some type of the appearance of an election where they will elect a new temporary provisional government. And it's hard to say how long that provisional government is going to last. But it's in this process, Stan, that they intend to manipulate. That is, they intend to carefully select and make sure that the broad-based Shiites do not have a say in this committee that's going to create the first interim government. And then for however long it takes, they're going to wait for this interim government with all the funding that they can get with America to propagandize the public into gaining popularity. And they're hoping at least to pull off a manipulated election in 1 or 2 years hence from them. But I think that's the way that they're planning on going right now.
All right. Well, really, it's so sad because, of course, the American people find it difficult to believe that this whole thing is manipulated, that we're really not interested in democracy there any more than we're interested in democracy in Egypt or in Algeria. We want a government that will do exactly what we tell it to do. And that, of course, is totally contrary to everything that we as Americans believe. But then we honestly believe we have two political parties that have separate agendas rather than, of course, one political party with two branches that has a unified agenda. And it's always the same other than, of course, they make an issue out of, abortion and family values and, of course, Republicans, we know, of course, are in favor of cutting taxes, but, and, of course, once in a while they do cut taxes and then they run up massive deficits because the Republicans refuse to cut spending, at least at the national level. Certainly at the state level, they do a pretty good job. And thank goodness here in California, we have some Republicans in the state legislature. But at the national level, we are going to run some of the biggest deficits that we've run since the days of Ronald Reagan, and people don't like to hear about it, but Ronald Reagan gave us the biggest deficits America had ever seen. Jimmy Carter gave us a $200 billion deficit in 4 years in office. Ronald Reagan gave us a $200 billion deficit on average every year he was in office for 8 years, and the national debt went from $1 trillion to $2.7 trillion during the 8 years of the Reagan presidency. But nobody ever says that, you see, because reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king.
You know, I have to remind your audience about something the president bragged about in his State of the Union message. I remember him with great gusto saying, "We will not put upon the backs of our generations the future cost of government." You know, he was saying we were not going to pass these along to the next generation. And this is exactly what every government has done. They have a very interesting philosophy, and that is, the way to stay in power is you never inconvenience the majority. And if that means lying to them, if that means covering expenses with paper money, with more fiat currency, with more indebtedness, and giving them tax cuts at the same time, I mean, that's why every responsible, even Democrats, are looking responsible now, because they're saying, how can we possibly give a tax cut when we're increasing the deficit?
Now, of course, nobody ever suggests we cut back on spending. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. In fact, the biggest increase in spending for education didn't come under Bill Clinton. It came under George Bush. I mean, for federal spending for education, not to actually educate our children, but to force education to comply with federal mandates aimed at changing the attitude and beliefs of our children.
But you know, what I don't think most people understand is that the United States government is using a multiplicity of methods to pay for things now that they didn't have before, never utilized before, and I'm speaking really ever since the Clinton years, where they, you know, this huge run-up in the economy in the 1990s was mostly done with credit creation and not through actual direct inflation that would show up in M1 or M2 in these various different forms of the money supply. But they actually created a great deal of credit. They expanded it through derivatives. They did a great deal of black budget type financing, which is all off the books. There's so much that's off the books now that what they're really doing is attempting to totally obscure the true financial situation from Americans. I mean, our total indebtedness, really, when we count all of the obligations from pensions and the loan guarantees we have, is way up past $21 trillion. It's not $5 or $6 trillion that is the official total indebtedness of the United States, but it's over $21 trillion. And so, and that's only, that doesn't even count the off-the-book things. That's the things that are on the book in terms of future obligations for the United States. This is very serious, because what it really means is we're going to continue to hide the true financial situation until we're faced with an absolute collapse someday. And it won't be a default in the sense of an announced default. Really, it will be that the currency will simply start to collapse, because the world will, in fact, know that the world is awash with dollars. And when it ceases to become a viable currency anymore, we're going to have a major currency collapse.
In fact, that's what they're doing. They're talking about, of course, dollarizing the Iraqi currency. And, of course, when they do that, a lot of the middle class will be wiped out, because they're not going to be able to turn all of their money in for dollars. And so, and once again, of course, the middle class are the ones that suffer.
But remember, as long as they dollarize, they continue to build an expansive market for dollars so that they can continue this hidden process of credit and monetary creation without it coming home to roost as inflation. We're the only country that's had this advantage over the years, being able to engage in massive double-digit inflation and not have it come home to roost, because we are the only country that has this whole world to absorb our currency. We'd be a banana republic, just like Brazil or Argentina, if we didn't have this world to absorb our currency. And so we're gaining a largesse that Americans are putting Americans to sleep in terms of our real financial situation.
Okay, fine. Well, what do you see happening over there in Iraq? I can see an awful lot of Iraqis being very unhappy with continued American occupation. America, of course, coming and talking about democracy, but putting the puppets into positions of power. And then, of course, bringing American corporations over there like Halliburton and, of course, allowing them to rape the American tax dollar payers, with these massive contracts that have been given without competitive bids to certain favorite companies like Halliburton, that, of course, Dick Cheney was the CEO of for so many years.
Well, Stan, I think this could go either two ways. And one of the ways in which the U.S. intends to solve almost all its problems is simply with flooding the world with money. And that includes Iraq. They're going to try to build a prosperity that has been unknown in Iraq in order to gain popularity. So we're going to see a huge Marshall Plan of investment in rebuilding Iraq. There'll be unemployment that the Iraqi people have never seen before. They're literally going to try to buy success out there. And this will work until, of course, they've flooded the world with money. And believe me, they can go a lot further than what they have and get away with this. So I think that's what they're trying. But I believe that underlying what we're seeing in here is a great deal of hostility towards Americans, especially if they tend to overstay their welcome. And I think that we could see at some future time a real guerrilla movement start to raise its head. Now, it's not going to be involved, I believe, with any of the former Ba'ath Party groups. I think the evidence is very, very clear that the Ba'ath Party, the Republican Guard leadership, as well as the key people in the Saddam Hussein regime were bought off, so to speak. And
that's why there wasn't any resistance, of course.
That's right. It's there's coming out now from Iraq itself various dissidents who have are saying the same thing, that all of a sudden they found these high-ranking Ba'ath Party people all disappeared on the same day. Now, you see, that wouldn't have happened if you had the top leadership go, and the medium leadership was still starting to fight, and then the lower leadership was still fighting, and then all of a sudden you'd have a domino effect going downhill. They all went on the same day, and they disappeared. And that speaks as if there was a deal cut.
In fact, but where do they disappear to? Where is Osama bin Laden? Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Where is Saddam Hussein? And they're all disappeared.
The U.S., of course, is still, you know, desperately searching for a few things to find, but more and more now they're starting to put out in public statements that, giving themselves excuses of why they may not find something. You know, Saddam Hussein probably shipped them to another country. Well, they know very well he shipped them to Syria. You know, that he perhaps destroyed them in the last days of the war so that they wouldn't be found. Well, we have no evidence of that either, because these things are not easily destroyed in a way in which cannot be picked up by U.S. surveillance. So I think the U.S. is clearly trying to cover for the fact that they did go in, as I long claimed in my World Affairs brief, under phony pretenses.
But the American people have already forgotten. Where is the outcry? Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Nobody's concerned about that now. And as a high-ranking member of these groups that control things said the other day, well, you know, it really doesn't matter whether we find any weapons of mass destruction. Anyway, I mean, they know how to make them, and so, you know, it would be a very easy thing if we weren't there for them to start making them all over again. So that's why we had to go in. And I'm listening, and I'm wondering, does anybody really believe that? And I, as I looked around the audience, why, everybody obviously did. Nobody even questioned that sort of a statement.
Well, it's interesting that the American people really do follow what the media lead them. They turn on their television sets, and wherever the... and that's why it's very important in the media that they only interview people who will basically state the party line. And there's a little bit of difference in opinion between the party line, but it's all in a similar ballpark, so that no one will ever hear on a major media someone saying the emperor has no clothes, this was a total fraud. You'll never hear that opinion on the mainstream media. It's only variations between the hawks and the lesser hawks, or the globalist internationalists versus the neoconservatives touting U.S. hegemony and remaking the world in the name of democracy. That's the only type of dissonance you see. There's an awful lot of pundits on the news media now talking about the so-called split between the State Department and the Pentagon, and this is really nothing of any significance, because they're two shades of the same party, and they of course have a few turf battles to fight out, but Colin Powell is no more in charge of the State Department than the man on the moon. The State Department has always been a very heavy pro-leftist organization that has always fomented and helped along leftist revolutions around the world, and there have been some infighting and factions prior to the past 20 years, but those have almost all now been eliminated. They all speak really with one voice.
We're going to have to interrupt today, Joel. We're going to have to take a break, and we'll be right back here with Joel Skousen. Welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and we're simply talking about his publication, World Affairs Brief, and, of course, what's really going on in the world, the information you're not getting from the controlled media. And before we go any further, Joel, let's get the address where people can get the World Affairs Brief from.
Well, the easiest way to see the World Affairs Brief is on my website, which is www.joelskousen.com. JoelSkousen. On that website, if you look on the archives in the World Affairs Brief section, you can get and read everything I've read from 2002 on back. It's kind of a mini history of the world. If you want some current samples of the World Affairs Brief, you can email me at joel@joelskousen.com, or you can give me a call at my office when I'm not on an interview like this, area code 801-224-4746, and I'll be happy to send out free samples of the printed edition of the World Affairs Brief, which is also available. It comes out at the end of each month. Same material, but typeset and printed out at the end of each month.
Okay, fine. Well, first, if you're out in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. I just wanted to share with you a call I had from a gentleman today. Talking with him, he goes to a church somewhere in the East, and he said, of course, his minister had been very, very supportive of the military adventurism that we engaged in. And of course, he isn't talking much about God or the Bible or Scripture. He's, of course, everything has to do with supporting the administration. And last week, he told the members of his congregation that if you don't like what's going on, you should just leave America. In other words, you oppose the war. And this poor fellow just didn't, he said, well, I'm just going to have to find a new church. I can't sit there and, of course, go along with that sort of approach. If you don't like the way things are going, leave America. Well, I think that one day, of course, as we move next into taking out Syria and then Iran and Saudi Arabia, and whether we do it militarily or by destabilizing doesn't really matter. That is the agenda. That's what's being planned. And, of course, I think that somewhere down along the line, I agree with Joel that this is going to precipitate a violent response against us from China or Russia. But we are moving into World War III. And, of course, everybody says, gee, war is so easy. We only lost 68 men in battle and another 40 or 50 wounded or killed by accidents over there. War isn't so bad. We saw it all on television. But what happens if our cities are smoldering embers? What happens if we use a nuclear weapon on somebody else and they do a preemptive strike on us? How could we possibly object to that? We established preemptive strikes are perfectly justified, and of course our leaders right now are developing nuclear weapons that can be used to blow up underground bunkers, things of that sort. I mean, I think that we're beginning to move into uncharted waters. And I fear that there, somewhere down the line, there's going to be a violent response to it. Why don't you pick up the story, though, from there, Joel?
You know, one of the things that Americans don't realize is that our own Bush administration is virtually handing the excuses to the rest of the world to attack us. And what I mean by that is, as long as America really truly represented freedom and liberty and did not intervene in other countries, it would be very difficult for other nations to justify to their own people that they're attacking America in the name of protecting the motherland, as Russia would, you know, always use, or Germany used in World War II. But when the America goes out and begins to antagonize the rest of the world, first in Bosnia, then in Kosovo, then in Macedonia, then in Afghanistan, now in Iraq, and later on, whether it's Syria, Lebanon, or Iran, this continues to antagonize the world and send a very, very clear message. You know, the American people may be buying what the Bush administration says, but nobody around the rest of the world believes it. And that's why America is becoming the ugly American. So the excuse to attack America is being justified by our own leaders by antagonizing the rest of the world and sticking it to them all the time. And secondarily, the Bush doctrine of preemptive strike, the first use of nuclear weapons, all of those are doctrines that Russia has not been lost on Russia. They have also said, well, we can use the doctrine of preemptive strike now in Chechnya. We can use it in any dissidents that we have. And they can also use it against the United States someday, in that someone had to stop this bully of the world from marching through. And I think that's what we'll see.
But, of course, if we have a right to use a preemptive strike on Iraq, what would keep us from using a preemptive strike on Russia? And of course, the Russians would look at it from that point of view and say, maybe we are endangered. Maybe we ought to strike first.
And in fact, they are using that doctrine to justify their continued building of weapons of mass destruction. That we need them because the U.S. is engaging in an arms race, destabilizing the world, and and we're going to have to protect ourselves. They're doing that even with the excuse of our ABM system. Whenever we talk about developing this ABM system, they say, well, we have to develop a lot more weapons of mass destruction in order to counter this. It doesn't make sense because then ABM is purely defensive. It can't reach. It doesn't even have a warhead on it. So it can't possibly do any damage to them. It can only mean, if the U.S. were willing to tell the American people what Putin really means when he says this, is that it threatens the Russians because it will perhaps keep them from doing a preemptive strike against the United States. Now,
but of course, the ABM system we're building will not prevent that. It's only aimed at, I think there are only going to be 20 missiles, and the Russians have about 7,000 last count.
Yes, even if we had 100 missiles, which our ABM system in Alaska, and by the way, it's being built as we speak, even without the American people know it. Now, that's typical of what the United States does. They say one thing, but do another. But the Russians are watching this, and it's very possible that this is a provocative move by the United States to scare Russia into finally making their move at some time. You know, the Russians have been delaying and delaying their move on the West for many, many years. The U.S. has bent over backwards to appear as if it's disarming, and it is disarming in many conventional ways, as well as our major MX missiles are being dismantled as we speak, which is very sad. That's one of the few deterrents that remained, which the Russians truly feared. Americans think they're protected by their submarines out in the ocean, but they fail to understand that in the 90s, the Russians made a secret pact with the U.S., or the U.S. agreed in a secret pact with Russia that they would keep 50% of their ballistic missile submarines in port at any one time.
And I even understand that we took out some of the missiles and we filled those tubes with cement so that we do not have the full contingent of nuclear tip missiles on our submarines anymore, do we?
No, that's correct. And then combined with PDD-60, of course, the military version of suicide by the Clinton administration, which has been maintained by the Bush administration, that we are not going to launch on warning. We'll absorb a nuclear first strike and then retaliate afterwards.
If we have anything to retaliate with.
Now, what do you have to retaliate with? Americans think they're going to shoot. If they think the Russians, the Chinese are going to shoot one or two missiles over just to test our response, they're kidding themselves. When we tell them in PDD-60 that we're not going to rely on launch on warning, that we will absorb a nuclear first strike, essentially, we're telegraphing the message to Russia that you're going to get a freebie. The first one's free. And if they know that, they're going to give us all they've got in one fell swoop.
In other words, they will try to take out all of our nuclear weapons.
Well, it's more than just nuclear weapons. I'm predicting the first day of the war, about 3,000 warheads. That's how many sensitive military targets we have, including satellite communication facilities, antennas, production facilities, and military bases around the world. It's going to take about 3,000 warheads. A lot of that is multiple 5 and 6 warheads on each of the underground bunkers that they want to hit. We do have a lot of underground areas in the U.S. as well. And that will leave us with precious little to strike back at, and with their huge underground complex in the Ural Mountains, the Yamato and Yazvinsky Mountain complexes, they can take virtually all of the other nuclear weapons that may survive in our submarines, and none of those are deep penetrating warheads. You know, they're not the big blockbuster warheads that we're capable of launching with the MX missiles. So I suspect the Russians fully intend to weather the storm of our retaliation, how weak it might be.
Well, I think that these are trying times, and of course I personally believe that these things are going to happen not only from a geopolitical point of view, but from a spiritual point of view, because God will not be mocked, and this country has been mocking God for too long. Well, anyway, Joel, we've talked about this as a very real possibility before. Do you think that when we go after Iran or Saudi Arabia, at what point do you think, do you have any thoughts at all, how far that we're going to be able to go over there, and of course in taking out the countries of the Middle East before there will be a response?
Well, it's interesting that the United States is backing off from moving into Syria. They were really rattling the saber for a little bit. I project now that because Syria is very compliant, You know, if the U.S. was really serious about weapons of mass destruction, they would blow the whistle on Syria. They know that Syria took possession of most of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. They're allowing Syria now to play as if they're going along, and Syria's ousted the Iraqi former staff that was there in Syria. They have turned over one or two token members of the Iraqi regime to the coalition forces, but they've really done nothing to disarm all of their biological and chemical weapons, and they have not stopped at all the harboring of terrorists. Most of the terrorists have headquarters in Damascus. Hamas, especially, Islamic Jihad is there. Hezbollah, you know, has headquarters there and operate freely in Lebanon with Syrian protection. And the U.S. is letting them get away with that. So we know that the U.S. is not doing this for beneficial purposes. There have to be ulterior motives, because if they were really going to be consistent, they would be challenging Syria, which is really one of the bad boys on the block, and they would be going after Iran. In answer to your question, I think that they could actually go into Lebanon without engendering a Russian reaction. They could actually go into Syria without engendering a Russian reaction. I doubt if they'd take over Iran without it. Iran's got a lot more people, a lot more mountainous terrain, a lot more Shiite fanaticism that would not tolerate a U.S. presence, that would not lay down their arms, plus the fact that they have tons of munitions that they've been building. They have multiple rockets at different stages, even three-stage rockets they've been developing with the help of Russia, China, and North Korea. They have hundreds of Chinese and Russian advisors in there. Certainly they could not tolerate a U.S. invasion of Iran without saying something. So what I'm predicting is that there's got to be a major trigger event to start the World War III. We notice that the United States is playing easy on North Korea right now, and they have been for years. As I pointed out in last week's World Affairs Brief, they preserved North Korea during the North Korean War. They kept North Korea from losing. When North Korea was losing, they allowed them, it was the U.S. that demanded a ceasefire once they got back up to the 38th parallel again. They could have continued to drive the North Koreans right back to the Yalu River, and they didn't do so because they wanted to create further conflict. They continued then to give aid and trade. They failed to sanction Russia or China all the years that they were shipping in material and technology to China. They continued to give them billions of dollars in food aid and nuclear energy aid and oil. And even today, Stan, they're talking now about having Cuban-type paper sanctions on North Korea. They say, in other words, we're not going to let you ship nuclear material out to other countries, talking about fuel processing and building plutonium. No mention, of course, about stopping North Korea from shipping out more Scud missiles to the rest of the world, which are weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
You see how selective these are. The American people nod their head and say, oh, look, the U.S. is being tough with North Korea. They're going to stop them from shipping plutonium. Well, we don't even have any knowledge that they have been shipping plutonium out. Why would they? They want to save as much as they can for their own nuclear weapons program.
But it's amazing.
It's kind of a red herring.
Of course, it's amazing how they can twist our reality with these phony statements. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling here from Los Angeles. Jerry, did you have a question for Joel?
Yeah, I did. Joel, what is your alternative to American world power?
All right, that's a very, very good question. What's your alternative to American world power?
Well, is the implication of your question, Jerry, that of how do we resolve the tyrannical problems around the world, or is it how do we install some more greater form of Republican government? I refuse to use the word democracy, but
what are you saying? What should we have done about Saddam Hussein? Would that be a fair question, Jerry?
Yeah. What should we do about Saddam Hussein?
All right, fine. Let Joel tell you what we should have done about Saddam Hussein.
Well, in the first place, we have to look at what I call the hierarchy of danger that we face. Saddam Hussein really wasn't a threat to the United States. They never made a credible case about involvement in terrorism in comparison to what Saudi Arabia was in terms of funding Osama bin Laden and terrorism. The greatest hierarchy of threat to the United States of America is Russia. The second hierarchy of threat is China. The third is North Korea. And, you know, Saddam Hussein and the rest are way, way down there on the list. I believe that, first of all, in foreign policy, you have to, you know, the United States allowed Russia and China to build, to be the enemies that they are. We gave Russia, for example, nuclear weapons. We gave them what plans they could steal through the Rosenbergs for their nuclear weapons. We gave them the rest of the plans and shipped them through the Montana Air Base during Lend-Lease supplies. So we were building, we made Russia what they are today through Lend-Lease and all the other plans during World War II. And so now that we've got such a huge enemy, and I don't believe, of course, that they're as weak as they proclaim, they're building weapons of mass destruction as we speak and hiding them in huge underground cities. But nevertheless, now they say to us, we can't challenge Russia because they are our nuclear guerrilla and they would strike back at us, and we can't challenge China because they would strike back and they'd threaten L.A. But we could do something. We could at least stop giving them technology transfers that help them to build up. We could at least start to strangle them financially so that they do collapse of their own weight, real, true sanctions. And we don't do that, even though we...
Joe?
Yes.
Saddam Hussein... North Korea...
All right, go ahead. Let's just take Saddam Hussein.
Well, anyway, Saddam Hussein was practically a client of Russia. So
he was.
So you would have been doing exactly what you say, according to your hierarchy of danger. Saddam Hussein had many deals with Russia, and were very much involved. That's why they were so dead set against us going there.
No, I'll agree with you.
We can't take on Russia. We can't exchange. Limited nuclear strikes with Russia. So we have to do what we can do. And I think Saddam Hussein was something we can do.
Well, right.
And that's why we went in there.
All right, fine. Joel, why don't you answer that, and then I'm going to answer that as well, because I think that this is the question that everybody asks, and nobody has an answer for. How would you respond to Jerry? Let's just take Saddam Hussein, because we're almost out of time, and I really want to get this one question answered once and for all. I think we have to understand how Saddam Hussein came to power, how Saddam Hussein kept power, and why we took the wrong approach to taking him out of power.
Well, of course, he was not only a client of the Russians militarily, but he was also a client of the CIA starting in 1959.
All right, fine. And where can people verify that? I mean, you're absolutely right, but could you give Jerry a book to read that would tell how Saddam Hussein was working for the CIA back then?
I know that already, but we're talking about not 1950, 40 years ago. We're talking about the last couple of years when things don't always stay the same. It's like I might have a good relationship with one person, and the next day, we might be enemies.
All right, but Jerry, let me just tell you, let me answer that, Joel. Forgive me for interfering, but first of all, Saddam Hussein was a CIA asset in 1959, 1960. There's a book written 10 years ago on Holy Babylon that goes into the whole incredible story. Now, the Ba'ath Party took control of Iraq, and I think it was in the late 1969, somewhere there. They only had 900 people. They took over a country of 25 million. Do you think they did that without the CIA? And then, of course, in 1979, Saddam Hussein seizes power and immediately starts getting help from the CIA, and we kept him in power, and he's a ruthless thug who's torturing people and pulling out fingernails and cutting off ears and killing people, and we backed him all during the 1980s, and we gave him the chemical, or allowed him to buy the chemical and biological weapons, and we allowed him to borrow large amounts of money from us, and in many instances we gave him $5 billion in agricultural credits, and we backed him after he used the poison gas on Iran in 1988. And then, of course, you know, after the Gulf War, we don't take him out. We let him take his helicopters up and slaughter the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north. And then, again, we allow him to smuggle oil to Turkey and Jordan so we can have a lot of money. And of course, when the military tries to overthrow him in 93 and again at least in 95, but certainly there's evidence in 93 as well, we block the Iraqi military from overthrowing Saddam Hussein. What does this suggest to you, Jerry? Do you think that this is happening by accident because we've got nothing but idiots back in Washington, D.C., or are we creating the best enemy money can buy?
Well, let me ask you, your statement was kind of illogical. You say the Ba'ath Party took over Iraq with 900 people and was only because of the CIA's backing. So how many agents did the CIA put into overthrow 23 million?
A lot of money. You do it with money. How do you think we overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979? We did not have CIA agents do it. We had a few CIA agents who passed out a lot of money to the right people, just as we overthrew Mossadegh in 1953. Premier Mossadegh was a legitimately elected prime minister of Iran. And, of course, there was a man at that time. His name was Schwarzkopf, Colonel Schwarzkopf,
yeah.
Who was a General Schwarzkopf's father, was over there working for Alan Dulles, passing out money. We overthrew Mossadegh. We overthrew the Shah of Iran. Oh, and, of course, I believe that the CIA has been over there creating all of these and destabilizing these countries. What is your thought on that, Joel?
Well, I agree with that, but I want to really go and I'm not going to accept the premise, you know, that Jerry is saying that we can't take on Russia. There's much that we could do, even within a couple of years, which we may have before, you know, Russia intends to strike at the very earliest. We could even secretly continue to build an Aegis sea-based system that could stop most of Russia's rockets in the boost phase, where you could stop them before the warheads separate. We could tell the American people to start building shelters. We could immediately stop all of the disarmament we're doing. We could get prepared for the war, which I believe is virtually inevitable. You know, we can diddle around stopping, and it would have helped counter Russia to stop their client states in Iran and other places, but nothing is going to stop the inevitable unless we begin to defend ourselves immediately and build defenses to get ready for a major preemptive nuclear strike by Russia. And that means stopping the transfers, stopping the money going to Russia so that they start to starve from that technology and start to really build our defenses. I think there is much that we can do that the American people would support.
Okay, anything else, Jerry?
Yes, I would agree. Iraq was taken over by, you know, money. That's what it's the mark of the beast. And also, Joel, you know, we are trying to do so, and I think there is a difference between Republican and Democrat, because Republicans are basically more or less more of a party focused on security issues, and we're trying to. I am a Republican, but I don't speak for the Republican Party. But you know, one of the platforms is a missile defense system.
Yeah, but we're not building a missile defense system. You say you're in favor of it, and then, of course, you build one with 20 missiles against 7,000 incoming ones. You have 20 missiles. And
no warhead on them. No warhead.
And no warhead. We're not trying, Jerry. You say one thing, you do another. Hey, we're out of time. God bless you. Thanks
for
calling. We're just about out of time here, Joel. What are your thoughts, you know? And I think that what you're pointing out is so valid. The Russians have a warhead on their missiles. We had warheads on our missiles, in 1970. But we can't put a warhead on our missiles today because they do not want us to have an effective ABM system. They want to leave America vulnerable, and don't think the Russians don't know that.
Well, Jerry brings up a good point. The Republicans stab themselves into saying we believe in all of these fine values and we believe in defense and things. What they don't realize, what's hardest for them to see, is that the administration literally is not doing what it says it is doing. It is doing just the opposite behind the scenes. It's giving us the rhetoric and the verbiage and the cover-up. but it is actually working against U.S. sovereignty, against the Constitution, against God, and against country.
In other words, there's a lot of rhetoric, but very little reality to that rhetoric.
And it's not because of ignorance. I'm a convinced person that there is collusion and conspiracy going to establish a new world order, take down our Constitution, and they're giving us the verbiage while undermining our liberties.
Okay, well, I really want to thank you so much for being with us. Do you have a parting thought? Why don't you get your telephone number and your website out there just one more time?
It's at joelskousen.com, and the office number is area code 801-224-4746. And I would encourage people to look at the archives because it is like a mini history of what's gone on in the past 4 or 5 years.
And I will second that. I always look forward to Joel's comments. I think you'll find them very astute and one of the things I read regularly every week when it comes. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Okay, fine. Well, that's been Joel Skousen. And hope you enjoyed it. And, of course, right now, of course, this is the time we have to remind you Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And so you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of our newsletter and you haven't had one before, the telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we'd be glad, of course, to get that off to you. And of course, I'd suggest you get on my March newsletter, which goes into the project for the New American Century. And you can verify everything we say simply by going to their website, newamericancentury.org, where you'll find out what the plan really is. Not what I say the plan is, but what they say the plan is. As they plan to permanently station American troops in the Middle East, and of course stations American troops throughout the world, like the cavalry on the new American frontier. Well, we're just about out of time, and so, of course, we certainly ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you, though, to pray for revival in America. Because I'm firmly convinced if the American people do not turn back to God, and there's not a revival here, why God is not going to protect or bless this country. And then, of course, we ask you to remember our ministry, Radio Liberty, and pray for our provision and our protection. And remember those words of Thomas Jefferson, God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. And so until tomorrow at the same time, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, we'll be doing another hour. We invite you to listen if you're here in the Monterey Bay area or listening to us on the Internet. And we'll be back in just a moment with the next hour's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. Of course, we want to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station, or other my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls. We're going to have an interesting program this next hour. We're going to be talking to David Shortis about his book, Like Sheep Among Wolves. It's the Felix Valencia story, and it's the story that he was told by Felix Valencia of his life of crime and then his conversion to Christianity. So, David, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you happened to meet Felix and then to write his story?
I'd be happy to. I started back in 1995 when a group from our church here in Joyce, Washington, made a trip down to Ecuador to help in the construction of two small church buildings way back in a very remote part of the jungle. The man who arranged that trip for us was Dr. Ron Guderian, who was a medical missionary with HCJB there in Quito. His wife was from our church originally, and so there was a strong connection there. We kept in touch with Ron frequently. And he arranged for a group of us to go down there and do this construction, and I went along.
What country were you in? Where were you going? What country?
Ecuador.
Ecuador, okay, fine.
I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. And yeah. So you go into Ecuador, and did you go out in the bush, out in the jungle, or where?
Very much so. It was quite a job to get there, in fact. Flew into Quito, got there late at night. Next morning, we took a bus down to Esmeraldas, which is down on the coast. And then from there, we took they call them buses, but they're really flatbed trucks with benches bolted to them. Out to a kind of a frontier town called Bourbon. And then we spent the night there. And then the next day we spent 6 hours in an outboard-powered dugout canoe going up the river, because the only way to get to these villages was by the river. So it was quite a feat to get there. And we worked in two villages. And both of these villages had Christian congregations that were under the directorship, pastorship, if you will, of this fellow Felix Valencia.
Okay. And so he's a minister there. But then how did you happen to meet Felix, and how did you happen to get him to tell the story?
Okay. Of course, we met Felix when we were there. He was actually very much in evidence as we were working on these buildings, and he was helping out, and he was responsible for material procurement and all that kind of thing.
How old was he at this time?
Oh, 30s.
All right, fine. So he had only really been a Christian for a relatively short period of time. What, a decade, a little bit more than that?
Something like that, that's right.
All right, fine. So basically, let's get into this story. It's a fascinating story because it sort of starts out with a group of four Ecuadorians. These three of them are dressed up in military garb, and they're carrying weapons, and they break into the home of a very well-to-do individual and beat him, half to death to get him to give the combination to the safe so they can steal his money. And Felix is one of these men, isn't he?
That's correct. He was the ringleader of the gang.
And of course, he was a communist, and he was they were going to steal money from the wicked capitalists to use for their purposes. But even at that time, he was beginning to wonder, if communism was exactly what it was cracked up to be. Is that right?
Well, that's true. He was very much committed to the communist cause at that time, but he was seeing some things as he got deeper into the organization. He was seeing some things that he really didn't like. Like money that was sent in from other countries, other communist countries, that was being diverted to individuals with personal bank accounts and that kind of thing.
Well, of course, I think as with most communists, or many, many communists, he honestly believed that this is sort of a division of, the money and, everybody lives equally. He doesn't really understand that under communism you have an elite, you have a military that keeps everybody else in line. It's really a return to feudal serfdom, but the average communist doesn't understand that. He thinks that, this is the ideal utopian world. But the reality is, it is establishing a new ruling elite who have all the money, and they simply are taking it from one group, giving it to themselves, and they're assuming their power, and then, of course, using that power once they are in position of authority to oppress the people, and many times even worse than the system they had before. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's pretty fair. Yeah, he was only 22 at this time when they committed this robbery, so he was a very young idealist, and his head was in the clouds, and he really didn't know what was going on.
So eventually, I mean, the story really reads very, very well, and you describe, of course, the apprehension of one of the members of this gang of four, and then, of course, his girlfriend eventually identifies the rest of them, and so Felix is arrested and taken to the local prison. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay, he ends up in prison and is transferred actually to a couple of prisons, but he ends up in the probably the largest prison in Ecuador in Quito, a very infamous prison. And prisons, I'll tell you, in Ecuador and maybe in South America in general, I'm not sure about that, but certainly the prisons in Ecuador are not nice, to put it mildly.
I mean, they don't have television and a workout gym and all these things. In fact, it's pretty ruthless, isn't it?
It's pretty ruthless. It was pretty much every man for himself. In fact, he found out that his life probably was in greater danger while he was in the prison than it would have been out on the streets. It was all sorts of corruption going on, and they allowed all sorts of crazy things to happen in the prison. Drugs were freely available. Prostitution was flourishing in the prison. All this sort of stuff. And he was there. And, to break that part down very quickly, his health was deteriorating. He was getting more and more depressed. He had asked for some help from his communist buddies as far as legal help, and they just turned their back on him, so he gave up on that. And he ended up getting a little Gideon New Testament just for something to read. But his father, way back when he was younger, had told him that if you ever get a chance to read the Bible and you really want to find out the truth that's in it, read the book of Revelation, of all things. Now, for anybody that knows the Bible, they know that the book of Revelation is pretty weird in places.
Yeah, that's the last place I would start myself, but that's all right. So what happened when he read the Revelation?
Well, God just opened up his eyes, and he just began to realize that there was truth there, and God used that to convert him. Now, he had an experience just prior to that with his cellmate. His cellmate was a Satan worshiper. He didn't know that at first, but he had a very, very vivid experience with this guy, and in which Satan became very real to him.
Tell me about that, because I think that's so important for our audience, because an awful lot of Christians don't even believe in Satan. They don't believe really in the supernatural, other than they think, well, maybe Christ did rise again, but we've got a lot of ministers who don't even believe in that. So then what happened, and certainly they don't talk about hell or Satan or eternal damnation in our churches today, because we wouldn't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable, and certainly the last thing we'd ever want to tell anybody is they're sinners. Robert Schuller has made that statement. He'd never tell anybody was a sinner because it'd make him feel bad. So anyway, what happened in the cell there with this man who was a Satanist?
Well, he was using tarot cards, and he would use them initially to tell Felix some things about himself that he had no other way of knowing. And Felix was quite fascinated with this power that this guy had. And he'd read these tarot cards and tell him about his various girlfriends and so forth and so on. And see, he gradually got pulled into this. And finally, after much cajoling, he convinced this fellow that he should let him in on his secret, how he knew these things. And so they had a late night session there in the cell, and he gave Felix something to drink. And of course, we don't know what that was. And under the influence of this, whatever it was, and it was not just liquor or something like that, but it was some drug or something, Felix had this vision. He saw this creature coming at him from afar off, little speck coming, slowly coming closer and closer and closer. And he describes this creature, sort of half man, half animal. And at the end, this creature just flings himself at Felix, and Felix screams, falls off his chair, lands on the floor, and wakes up, as it were. And he looks at his friend there and says, what was that? And the guy says, well, that was the devil. And so, of course, Felix is scared out of his wits and leaves, he can't leave, they're in their own cell, but he'd go to bed, and that was the end of it for the night. But the next day, he's thinking about this, and he thinks, well, you know, I saw the devil. So if there's a devil, then there must be a God, too. And so that was sort of the thing that kicked it off then. And then when he got this New Testament, he started reading about God, and things began to open up for him, and he began to realize what it was all about.
And so here he is, he's in his cell, he's, in his early 20s, he's been thrown out of the army, and the army wants to get him. In fact, there's a fellow in the army who hates him because he's a communist, and in fact, it was just fortunate he wasn't turned over to the army because, of course, he'd carried out this crime wearing a uniform, pretending to be a member of the army. That, they would have really given him a bad time. It's bad enough being in this sort of hopeless prison. But now, of course, he's beginning to realize that, in this sense of hopelessness that he has, that there is truth in God's word. So then what happens?
Okay, well, then he really starts thinking about this, and he continues to read. I mean, he's just, it's only a New Testament plus the Psalms and Proverbs. So then he decides to go back and he reads through the Psalms. Well, of course, the Psalms are filled with all kinds of passages of hope, there's the description of where he brought me out of the miry clay and all of that sort of thing. And he sees himself in those positions and realizes that only God can lift him out of this. And so he continues to be uplifted by it. And then he goes on into the Gospels, and he's reading about Jesus and what he did and how he lived his life and what he taught. And one of the things that he taught was, you should love your enemies. And you should forgive those who have harmed you. And he had a lot of enemies in that prison. He had some guys in there that were enemies before he even went to prison for various things that he had done to family members and that sort of thing. And so he realized that he was going to have to go to these guys, and he was going to have to try to explain to them that he was forgiving them, and that he held no more grudge against them and that kind of thing. And so he did. It took his life in his hands, really, to do that. But he did that, and it didn't take his life. The guys didn't. They couldn't believe it. They thought he was crazy. But he survived that, and then he went on from there, and he began to talk to other prisoners. And of course, most of them rejected him. They laughed at him and so forth. But a few of them didn't. And slowly, little by little, he began to accumulate a gathering, a following in there in the prison. And they began to have Bible studies. Now, in the meantime, he had told his cellmate, the Satan worshiper, he didn't want any more to do with him. And so he left. They apparently were free to, he didn't leave the prison, but he left the cell. And so he was by himself. And then, through God's grace, he brought another guy into his life, who a younger man than he, who was actually a pastor's son, who'd gotten into trouble, he'd stolen some things, and got caught, and he was very contrite. And he had come to Felix because Felix now had kind of developed a reputation among the authorities there of being a kind of a chaplain. Now, he wasn't an official chaplain, of course, but when people would come along and ask for spiritual help, why, sometimes the authorities would send him to Felix. And they sent this young man to Felix, and he took him in and took him under his wing and helped him out. And they became very, very close friends. And it was sort of a Paul-Timothy relationship, you know. The older man now, still, I mean, he wasn't really all that well-versed in the Bible and all that, but he knew more than this kid did. And so they worked together then, and he continued to build up the fellowship there.
All right, so then, of course, he's out, he's ministering to the other prisoners, and does the attitude of the administrator there at the prison change at all towards him with this?
Well, to some extent, yeah. He realizes that Felix is a changed man. He sees that. I mean, Felix was pretty belligerent before his conversion. I mean, he was a pretty nasty guy. In fact, it's kind of interesting, and after I wrote the book, I talked to one of the missionaries who worked with Felix there in Quito, Larry Buckman, who's mentioned in the book quite prominently. And after Larry read it, he said, boy, he said, you got a watered-down version of what kind of a guy Felix was. he kind of held things back from you. He was pretty vile, and he just didn't tell you all the gory details. So he was a totally changed guy. He was completely transformed. And so I'm sure that, you know, the authorities saw that and recognized that. They didn't give him any special deals or anything, but nonetheless, he was sort of the chaplain of the prison.
Well, then how long was he in prison altogether, and how did he get out of prison?
Yeah, he was in prison for 2.5 years. The normal sentence for a robbery, an armed robbery like that, I think was 6 years. But he was a first offender, and when they had the hearing, they finally had a hearing. I mean, they didn't have their hearing until like a year or two after they were in there. He pleaded guilty. All the other guys pleaded innocent, but he pleaded guilty. And in a sort of a controversial point in the book, he elects not to finger his friends. He made up the story and asked God for forgiveness immediately, but he made up the story that the guys who helped him on the robbery were not these fellas, but that they were some Colombian guerrillas that happened to be passing through. And because he, because of his testimony, these guys were not given as large a sentence, and he was given an even lower sentence. He was given, I think, 3 years to start with, and then he had time off for good behavior, and it ended up being about 2.5 years.
All right, so then, of course, now he's going to get out of prison, and so what happens to him at this point?
Okay, he's going to get out of prison, and he doesn't know what to do. He would like, he wants to be a pastor now. He's committed to being a minister, a preacher. He wants to go into that, but he knows that he has to go to school before he can actually become a pastor. And he talks to this young man that he has befriended and learns about a Bible college there, a one-year Bible institute there in Quito. And amazingly enough, I can't go into all the details because we don't have time, but, I mean, read the book, you know. But he is admitted to this Bible college the day after he's released from prison. And although there were some people who were opposed to his admission, it turns out that this young man that he's befriended, his father, was on the board of this school, and he put in a good word for him and told him how he had befriended his son and brought him around and so on and so forth. And so they let him in. And so he walks out of prison and basically walks into Bible college. And so the next year, he spends there at this Bible college there in Quito.
Well, you know, one of the most amazing things, David, one of the great evidences that there is validity in the scriptures is really how it transforms people's lives. And I'm sure you've seen other instances, and I have too, where some of the most disreputable, meanest, nastiest people in the world, their lives are transformed when they finally give their life to the Lord. Have you noticed that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, we have some kind of, sometimes we have a tendency to write people off, as it were. You know, that guy is so bad, you know, that he could never become anything. And so we just write him off and say, no, we won't bother with him. And that's wrong. That's wrong. We shouldn't do that. And this is a good example. This guy was bad, bad, bad. And look what God did with him.
Amen to that. Well, that certainly is true. And so basically then, of course, Felix takes his year of Bible college, and then what happens to him?
Well, one thing that happens is he meets a young woman there that he wants to be his wife, but through a series of circumstances why he is unable to marry her right away because he doesn't have a job, and her parents won't let her marry anybody if he doesn't have a job. So he graduates, and he's very despondent because he can't get married. He thought he had a job, and that fell through. And so he goes off to Guayaquil, which is a city down on the coast, and he spends some time down there. And he tries, that happens to be where his girlfriend's family lives, and he tries to see her, and her parents won't let him in and all this kind of stuff. And when they finally do get together, basically the mother kicks him out and says, look, you know, here you are, you're not earning any money, you can't support my daughter. And he's just really, he hits rock bottom there despondently. And so he says, well, there's nothing else for me to do. I'm going to go back to Anshiaku, his home village back on the river. And he said, I'll go out there and I'll help my mom and I'll do some farming and that'll be it. But I think maybe before I do, I better go back up to Quito and visit some of my friends. Now, what I didn't mention was that after his conversion and after he got involved in ministry in the prison, he got involved with the HCJB missionaries in their prison ministry there in the prison. And he became pretty close to some of those guys. And so he decides to go back to Quito and pay them a visit. And so he goes into Larry Buckman's office, talks to him. Now, Larry Buckman had been away the whole year he was in Bible college. Larry Buckman worked with him while he was still in prison, but Larry left just about the time he got out and had been off for a year, so he was back. So Larry says, well, what are you doing, you know? And incidentally, his Spanish name is Lorenzo Buckman. So I use the name Lorenzo in the book. And so he says, well, I'm going back home. He says, I don't know. I don't think I can make it in the ministry. And so old Larry, he stops and thinks about it. He says, you know, he says, we just got some money to support prison ministry. He said, what do you think about becoming a prison minister, going back into the prison from the outside now to minister in the prison? Well, of course, this is very attractive to Felix. And he says, and I'll tell you what. He says, what we'll do on top of that, he said, we'll give you a scholarship to go to seminary. Because Felix had done very well in Bible college. And so it was obvious that he was a good student. He says, we'll give you a scholarship to go to a seminary of your choice. And the upshot of it is that he goes to a seminary there in Quito, and continues to work in the prison ministry. He now has a job, so he goes to his future mother-in-law and says, look, I'm making some money now, not much, but I'm making money. And so he and his girlfriend get married, and that's his wife of today. And so then they struggle. Over the next 3 years, he's in seminary, and they have a really tough time. They have kids, she can't work, and he's working part-time. in his prison work, trying to go to school, and has some real ups and downs. But finally, he makes it. He gets all the way through, and as especially during the last year in seminary, he gets a job, a part-time job, as a youth pastor in one of the big posh churches there in Quito, one of the evangelical churches. And so he's preaching around the city. In fact, he's preaching around the country. And he's becoming fairly well known and making a name for himself. And he's a big success with the kids in the church there. And as he graduates, his senior pastor comes to him and he says, "Well, now what are your plans?" And he says, "Well, I don't know." And he says, "I guess I'll try to get a church somewhere." And he says, "Well, you know," he said, "the people like you really here on the board is ask you whether you'd like to stay on full time." Well, of course, this is great, you know, a wonderful opportunity. And then through a series of circumstances.
Oh, you're sort of fading away. Are you on a regular hardline phone?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Well, the senior pastor here is an old guy, and he's getting kind of daughtery. But Felix is talking to Larry Buckman. And he's talking to Ron Guderian, the medical missionary that we know up here. And Ron has worked with these prison guys, and he's worked with the rural ministry. Ron he worked with river blindness, which is a disease that was rampant in the country. And so he'd go out on the rivers and to work on his research program, and of course try to carry the gospel with him wherever he could. And so in talking to both these fellas, Felix gets the idea that maybe he ought to be going back out there to his own people because there is no real sustained Christian witness for them out there. Well, to make the long story short, he finally decides to turn down the offer for the posh job. The senior pastor is, of course, extremely upset by this. And tries to talk him into it and says, "Now look, you know, I'm old and I'm about ready to retire, and when I retire, they'll probably make you senior pastor and you'll just have the world by the tail." And, but that notwithstanding, Felix finally decides not to do that and to go back out to the village where he grew up. And so that's what he does. He takes his wife and three kids with minimal, minimal support, and starts his work out there, real bootstrap operation. He starts it on a shoestring. He has very little to support him. Ron Guderian did find some money to help him build a house and eventually to build a church there, but it was a real struggle. So he goes out there, and that was about 1985, somewhere in through there, when he went out. And we met him in 95, so it was about 10 years later. And in that 10 years, he built up a fantastic ministry, worked like crazy, of course, to do it. But he had congregations all up and down that river system, and that's why we were there, to build buildings for these congregations, for two of them. So,
I think it's an amazing story, of course, what can happen to a person, you know, when they open their mind to the Lord, and how he can actually transform lives, because so many of those people within the prison system live a life of sort of hopelessness.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Of course, to take something like that, of course, to really get their attention and begin to transform their lives. We're going to have to take a break here. When we get back, we'll invite your calls from out across America at 464-8295 or here in this, that's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is David Shortis. His book, Like Sheep Among the Wolves, the Felix Valencia story, and of course the front page of the book just shows this little village out in the middle of the jungle there, palm trees every place, surrounded, of course, by forests. It must be pretty primitive there, isn't it?
Absolutely. Incredibly primitive. If you can imagine living somewhere where there's no electricity, no telephones, no roads, no sewer system, that's Anchiaku. That's the village. And that picture on the front of the book, incidentally, is an actual photograph of Anchiaku, the village where Felix lives.
How do the people make a living there?
Well, they're basically sustenance farmers. They grow their food. Now, of course, you realize that this is located basically on the equator, so it's tropical, very tropical. They don't have any winters to speak of. So they can grow crops year-round. They grow a lot of their own food. They have some animals. We saw some cattle and pigs and things like that when we were there, chickens. They fish in the river. They get fish. They do have some cash crops that they will sell, and that gives them some money to buy what few things they need, which aren't very much. I mean, they don't need much in the way of clothing because it never gets cold. They don't need much in the way of houses for the same reason. Their houses are very, very meager huts, as it were. They need pots and pans, for example, to cook with. I was impressed by the almost total lack of furniture in these places. They sit around on their porches, on their doorsteps, but they don't have chairs. They have little stools occasionally, but they just don't bother. And so, but their cash crops include bananas. They grow bananas, so they'll send. You see a canoe going down the river every now and then, loaded to the gills with bananas. They sell one of their big cash crops is cocoa beans. They take the pulp off of the cocoa beans. A very interesting procedure. Many of them simply chew the pulp off of the outside because apparently it's sweet and tastes good. And after they chew the pulp off of the bean, then they take the bean out, wash it off, and put it out in the sun to dry. And after they dry, they bag them up and send them off to wherever, and they make chocolate out of it.
Now, this is not what they make cocaine out of.
No, we didn't see any evidence of any of that sort of thing right there.
Okay. And so, basically, of course, it's pretty much subsistence living. Well, why do people stay there? Is it this is just their way of life? They don't know what to do otherwise.
Well, most of them stay there. Some of them don't. Felix went to he ended up going down to the big city. He was familiar with Esmeraldas, for example, and that's where where his communist buddies were when he was young. But for many of them, it's just where they grew up, and that's where they stay. They don't have any way to get out. Many of these people are not educated. Excuse me, I didn't get into his school. That's another thing that he started there.
All right. So, what about is it mostly the missionaries that provide the medical care for the people?
Well, from what we could tell, now people like Ron would come through periodically and provide some basic medical needs. Sometime before we got there, and I don't know the history of this, but there was a medical team that came into the village where we stayed, and there was actually a two-story building constructed to house a clinic. And these doctors, I think there were four or five of them, lived up on the second floor, and then they had their clinic on the first floor, and a lot of their, they took care of basic needs, but they also did some training. And I guess they were operating under a grant of some sort, because when the money ran out, they did leave behind some local fellas who were trained as sort of paramedics and who could stitch up wounds and pull teeth and take care of basic needs like that. And in fact, we saw some of that happen while we were there, because that building was the building in which we stayed. And we had our living quarters upstairs. There were more than four of us, however. and then we the downstairs remained as the clinic, and so these people would come in from time to time. And I remember one fellow came in with a pretty nasty machete gash on his leg, and the guy sewed him up. And somebody else needed a tooth pulled, I think, or something like that. Of course, we were out working most of the time, but so I was impressed with a couple of things medically. You often see these guys standing out side of their huts, brushing their teeth. Apparently, there must have been a big emphasis on keeping on dental health. And you'd see them standing out there brushing their teeth. Also, I was impressed with the fact that most of these people looked fairly healthy. The young men were robust. They were not emaciated. The kids, there were millions of kids around. And they looked pretty healthy. They looked like they were being fed well. So apparently, these guys had given some instruction on nutrition and personal health care and that sort of thing.
So then what, you were just building, you built a church for them there, or were you building other buildings? Most people must have had their own homes, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, sure. That was the village. The village was made up of these, I call them huts.
I mean, how many people were in the village, do you think?
Oh, the village we were in, I would guess there were several hundred.
All right. Now, what about the church then? Did you build a church there for them?
That's right. We put up a small building, cinder block building, cement block building. I would guess it was probably, oh boy, I hadn't thought about this for a while. I would say maybe 15 by 20. No, not that big. Maybe more like 15 by 15, something like that. Maybe 15 by 20 is fairly accurate. Very simple building, no windows, of course no electricity. The way they build them there is they put a solid wall up about 6 feet, and then above that they put wood slats, which allows not only light to come in but allows air to circulate. And then they just put a roof on it. And that's it. That's the kind of building that we two of those we constructed. And then they put a concrete floor on. And I've often wondered how well that concrete floor held up, because what they did was they got river rocks, round river rocks about size of oranges or that size, and they'd bring them up out of the river, and they'd spread them out on the floor, and then they'd take a big stomper, and they'd just smash them down into the soil is quite heavy clay. They just smash those rocks down into the soil and get it fairly level, and then they just mix cement by hand. Everything, of course, was done by hand. They'd mix cement right there on the ground, and just spread a thin layer of this over these rocks, and there's the floor. I don't know how long it holds up, but and all the mortar for the concrete blocks that we laid was all mixed by hand, mixed on the ground with a shovel. They didn't even have hose. They didn't even have a box to mix it in. Just mixed it on the ground.
You know, it doesn't seem possible that this be going on this day and age, but so much of the world, you know, lives, you know, a bare subsistence level here in the United States. Why, you know, we've been so, well, we've just been so blessed that we take all of these things for granted.
That's right. And while, you know, we'd look around us and we'd say, you know, well, there's a simplicity here that is somewhat attractive. But then we'd look at all the lack of amenities that we're so accustomed to, and we think, no way could I live here.
No, I know. Well,
not like these people live.
No. Well, of course, they never having enjoyed the things that we do. But, of course, Felix would have, and yet, of course, he gave up the opportunity for a prosperous and life in the big city to go back and help the people there. Is there a growing Christian population? Is the church growing there?
Oh, it is. It is. We have been told now that these buildings, both of them, have been outgrown. They it's strictly standing room only anymore. And I don't know any more details than that. But one of the things that Felix has felt very strongly about, and this is covered in the latter part of the book, he started a school, a Christian school, because while they had government schools in these villages, most of the time they were non-functional because they couldn't get teachers to go out there and stay. And so the kids weren't getting an education, and they were growing up illiterate. They couldn't read or write. And so therefore, if they did go anywhere, they couldn't get any kind of a decent job anyway. And so he started this school, and the school has proven to be an incredibly successful venture. I can't give you the numbers right now, but they bring kids in from up and down that river by canoe every day to attend this school. And he's been able to get teachers to come in, Christian teachers, and they graduated their first class here, I think it was just this past year. And of course they started with down in the lower grades, gradually expanded as the kids got older, and eventually got into high school and developed a high school program. And so he recognized the importance of education and bringing these people out of the dark ages and bringing them out of this very primitive existence in which they're forced to live.
Well, of course, one of the original reasons for education in the United States was so people could read the Word of God. That was the whole idea. And if these people can't read, they're certainly not going to be able to get the Word of God.
Exactly. That's right. And he recognized that. And, of course, being a Christian school, that goes right along with it. And I might mention, too, now we talked earlier about the spiritual warfare that he encountered in the prison. Well, he encountered the same thing out there. Satan was not going to let him get away with this. And he sent a fellow in to work with Felix, who looked like, on the surface, like he was a godsend. But he turned out to be a Satan sinned, as it were, and nearly wrecked the school. But eventually they came out of that. But that was pretty frightening experience to have to deal with this guy, because he was not a Christian, even though he claimed that he was. And he didn't spare much to try to get his own way during his short term there.
Oh, you know, it's really interesting, but you see this so often. People will profess to be Christians, and they come in simply to disrupt whatever the Lord's trying to do in a specific field, whether it's a Christian school or Christian ministry. And you have to understand how important Christianity is, because it must be very important. Otherwise, there wouldn't be people working so hard to destroy it all the time.
Well, I certainly couldn't agree more. And I certainly thought about that. That if this wasn't valid, if the school wasn't valid, if the work wasn't valid, if it wasn't worthwhile, Satan wouldn't bother with it, or these people wouldn't bother with it. But they went to considerable lengths to try to destroy this. And, so I'm sure that's quite true. I heard a saying years ago that. If you're not suffering some kind of setbacks and persecution, what you're doing probably isn't worthwhile.
Yes, in other words, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Well, what did you hope to really accomplish by writing the Felix Valencia story? And it's a fascinating story and really very, very well written. But
thank you.
What was your purpose and goal in doing this?
Well, I guess I'd have to say right at the outset that I felt that this was a story that God wanted written. He put me there. Now, when I went down there, I was 65 years old. I was the oldest guy in the whole group. And I never was very much of a worker in terms of physical labor and that sort of thing.
So you were a college professor, weren't you?
I was a college professor, that's right. You know, we don't have to break our backs in our work. Anyway, but I did go, and I have to confess that certainly, probably at least a small part of my reason for going was just because I like to travel and I like to see other things. And I when I found out that they were going to be going into the primitive jungles of Ecuador, I was quite fascinated with that. But I think, as I look back now, and as I felt at the time, God wanted me to write that story. He wanted that story to get out. He wanted people to know what's going on down there. I think it's important to see a missionary story about a man, not from another country, not from another culture, but from his own mission, his mission work to his own people. And I think that's important. We hear so many stories about North Americans or Europeans going into Africa or Asia or wherever, South America, and working, and they do good work, and I'm not belittling that at all. But here was a guy that was right there. He was right from that culture. And the second thing is, I certainly had hoped that through this book, I think I make pretty clear what the gospel is all about, and that was certainly intended. When Felix is leading others to the Lord, he lays out the plan of salvation very clearly to them, and I put that in there. And it is my hope that through reading this book, that some people may be led to the Lord.
Well, I think it will impact on some of the readers. How can people get hold of your book?
Well, unfortunately, the book is published by a rather small, little-known publishing company called Publish America. And I have discovered, since I have been with them, they're not a vanity press, but they do pay royalties, all of which are going to Felix's ministry, but they do not do anything in the way of promotion or advertising. And also, they are a print-on-demand publisher, and so the usual Christian book distributor, which is, I guess, the biggest one, is Spring Arbor. Spring Arbor is not carrying any big supply of these, and so the Christian bookstores go to Spring Arbor and say, well, we want to, somebody's ordering this book, and they say, well, we don't have it, or we have to wait a while to get it. They can get it. But your Christian bookstores certainly should be able to get it. You can order directly from Publish America, and they have an 800 number. Which,
go ahead.
Can I give that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. It's a toll-free number. It's 877-333-7422.
And that's 877-333-7422. If anybody's interested, a very touching story, very well written story. Of course, one man conversion, and of course, then the dedication of his life to the people there in the jungles. Go ahead.
You probably recognize where I got the title. You remember when Jesus was sending out his disciples two by two, and he tells them now. They say, well, what do we do, and what can we expect? And he says, well, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. And Felix comments in the story that they, when they went out on the river, they felt like that. He says, we felt like the disciples when Jesus sent them out to minister in the towns and villages of Israel. You remember what he said to them? I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves. And that's a tough combination. Shrewd as snakes, innocent as doves. We certainly can't do it by ourselves. We must have the Holy Spirit working through us. And then he goes on to talk about another experience he has.
Well, of course, it's just sort of a dogged determination on the part of God's people to bring the word to people, in one area, another area. Certainly I work here in the United States hoping that maybe something we say on radio may touch somebody's life. But it's so important that there are people all throughout the world doing exactly the same thing, each one where God has placed them.
Well, that's certainly true. And one of my favorite expressions is, grow where God plants you. And he will grow you, indeed. And Felix was planted back there in his home village. We're planted in our home villages here, and we should be doing what we can to follow the Lord's leading. And that's what I have felt I have done. I could go into a lot more detail on some rather remarkable events that took place in the preparation of the book. I mean, here's Felix down there in Ecuador in the jungle. He speaks Spanish. He doesn't speak English. Here I am up here in Western Washington. I speak English. I do not speak Spanish. How do I get the story? Somebody told me I ought to write another book just on how I got the story.
So how did you get the story?
Well, I started out with talking to Ron about that very problem. How do we do it? And so I suggested, I said, well, look, I said, if you can find, this was when he was there in Quito. I said, if you can find a translator, somebody who's really bilingual, and who knows that area where Felix lives, I'd be willing to come back down, bring a tape recorder and tapes with me, and go out with that person, and we'd spend a week out there, and we'd interview Felix and get the whole story translated on tape, and then I'd take it from there. Well, Ron thought that was a pretty good idea, and he said he'd work on it. About a year later, Ron and his wife came to our church, as they frequently did. They were back in the States. And I cornered him, and I said, what about our Felix project? Are you getting anywhere on that? And he said, well, I haven't gotten anywhere with it, but I haven't forgotten about it. I'm still working on it. I said, well, okay. That was a year. About another year passed, and I got word that Ron and his wife had decided to come back to the States permanently. Ron felt like he had done all he could on his river blindness work, and so he was wanting to get into something else. So I thought, well, that's the end of that. I've lost my contact down there. And then another year went by, and I learned that, lo and behold, Felix and his wife were coming to the States. Not only were they coming to the States, but they were coming to Washington because Ron and his wife were living over in Everett. They had decided to move there, I think because his wife was from this area. And they were coming up to visit the Guderians. And not only that, but Felix and his wife were going to be coming out to our church because our group had gone down, and of course he knew some of these people. And he spoke in our church. And when I learned that, I called up Ron's wife, and I said, I haven't been able to get down to talk to Felix down there. Is there any way that I could talk to him up here? And Eleanor looked at her calendar, and she said, you know, this is amazing. She said, he's booked solid through the Sunday that he's speaking out at your church. He's not leaving here until Thursday, and I don't have a thing for him for Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. Why don't you get a tape recorder and bring it on over and come over to the house and see what you can do? And so I did. And I ended up with 10 hours of Felix's dictation
in Spanish. In Spanish, right.
Yeah. No, there was no translation here because they didn't have time to sit down with me, and we only had 3 days. So I asked Ben, I said, well, how am I going to get this translated? And they said, well, Eleanor said, my Spanish isn't good enough, and Ron doesn't have time. And so I took my tapes and went home. And then I remembered a couple that we knew in New Mexico that I had taught with in the college. She taught Spanish, Christian believers, neighbors of ours, in fact. And they had just retired. And I called her up and asked her if she could help me out. And she said, sure. She would translate the whole thing for me. And so I sent her the tapes. And she not only translated it onto another set of tapes in English, but she wrote out the whole translation verbatim. And so I had the whole thing there in front of me. And so I took that, and that was formed the basis for the book. And then later on, I was able to get some more details through a fellow by the name of Ted Waring, who works with Felix. he's in Florida, and he handles the contributions that are given in the States for Felix's ministry. And so he was able to get some information for me as well. So it's been an interesting story, and a lot of, quote, coincidences? No way. God's hand's been in this thing from the beginning.
Well, of course, he works in very, very strange ways, and it's a far cry from being a college professor there teaching in New Mexico to being off in the jungles of Central America, and then, of course, to writing the book. Well, I want to thank you so very much, really, for spending the hour with us. Again, the book is Like Sheep Among the Wolves, and, of course, if you want to get that, the telephone number is 877-333-7422. And, of course, you put a lot of work into it. It's hard to get books distributed today. I hope that perhaps some of our listeners want to get it. It's a very heartwarming story to realize that the Lord can reach out and touch the hearts of really anybody that, no matter how depraved or how wicked and how terrible they've been. And there is that hope that, of course, if it can happen to Felix, it can happen to anyone.
That's right. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to share, and obviously I'm quite enthused about this whole thing, and I'd sure like to see it in the hands of a lot of people.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so very much, and good night. God bless you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
So long.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed this. It's a little different approach tonight, but it is really a well worthwhile, well-written story. And, of course, you can just feel the bitterness of this young man, repudiating society, seeing all the injustice in society, becoming a hardcore communist, ready to go out and rob from people to raise money for the party, and then, of course, realizing that suddenly that the party so all these people who talk about redistributing the wealth really want it redistributed to themselves. And then, of course, when he is captured and put in prison, and it's a very, very hopeless position, why, of course, the party turns against him. And so he doesn't know where to turn. He has a father. Father can't do much of anything for him. And, of course, it's really, looking at the future there in that sort of a prison, you wonder how many long you're going to live. It's a horrible, horrible place. And then, of course, to find the promise of eternal salvation there, and a transformed life simply because somebody had given him a Gideon Bible. Well, it's a wonderful and heartwarming story, and I certainly recommend it to you. Again, the book Like Sheep Among Wolves. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you would like to perhaps join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. And just found we have another new station in Kansas is pulling down our afternoon programs. That's exciting. And FM station there. And the more people that hear the truth, sooner or later, of course, hopefully, what we say will have an impact on them. So we ask you, of course, to, if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And let me suggest you ask for the March newsletter, because that gets into the project for the new American century. The people who control the presidency, I don't know what George Bush knows about their policies, but if you want to know about their policies, you go to their website. It's newamericancentury.org, thenewamericancentury.org. If you have our March newsletter, why, we simply will point you a pathway so you don't have to read all of the verbiage, although you can certainly read it and study it. You can pull it down off the Internet. The most incredible story of how a small group of men began meeting back, well, actually there's one woman among them, in the spring of 1997. And set out to take control of our government, to go to war with Iraq, to change our military, and of course to capture executive branch of our government. They've done it. It's their information, newamericancentury.org. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. And please, of course, remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. And again, if you want that a free copy of the newsletter, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war today.
about